Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast with me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
Well, spring has sprung. We know this in the UK because, in the words of that genius musical duo Flanders and Swan, April brings the sweet spring showers on and on for hours and hours. Have you heard that, Sian?
No.
April brings the sweet spring showers on and on for hours and hours.
But we also know it in London because the London Book Fair has just happened and the Man Booker International shortlist has been announced. It feels as if the literary world has opened itself up like a peacock flaunting its feathers, albeit rather damply, for the year ahead. This week, we're looking at what's hot around the world. We're going to hear from Benedict Wells, the German wunderkind, whose book The End of Loneliness is set to continue its conquest of Europe in its new English translation. But first, we're here, flush from the London Book Fair. Flush or flushed, Sian.
Yeah.
And maybe
exhausted.
Flushed out. Flushed out is the word.
Tired.
It's 3 days in the Kensington Olympia Exhibition Centre, for those who don't know it, with the whole of the world publishing in it. And it's sort of massive because it's like a huge, great aircraft hangar.
Yeah.
But it's very light and big, but it's also airless. You've just realised you're breathing everybody's breath for 3 days.
It feels like you're in an airport for about 3 days and you just can't leave. But you've got to keep talking to people. Someone described it wonderfully to me. They said it's like forcing 2,000 introverts to talk to each other for 3 days, which is basically what the books world is. It's full of introverts.
And interestingly, that was a very smart piece of marketing. By this year's focus was the Baltics, and the Latvians had this brilliant campaign, which was called #IAmAnIntrovert.
Yes, and when you went to the toilets in the London Book Fair, they had posters on the back of the doors that said, like, aren't you glad for a quiet minute alone, sort of thing. So all the introverts were going into the bathrooms and hiding for 10 minutes just to sort of recuperate.
Well, it could be a bit of a problem if you actually needed the loo, because it was all full of introverts just having time out. Anyway, what did you find out there?
Oh, well, it was a very interesting year. I mean, basically I just sort of walked up the floors and spoke to publishers and spoke to agents and listened to talks, and it's quite a weird big event. But what I got two very different stories. The publishers are very, very optimistic this year and they're very happy to throw money at things. But when you actually look at what they're buying, you kept seeing these auctions that were going on that would have 13 publishers fighting for one book. And one agent talked to me about that and said that that's actually not a very good sign, because they're basically all just trying to follow a trend. If they spot a trend, then they're all lumping in on the same books and trying to buy them. And only one of them is going to get it. So then they all end up buying books that are similar. And this is when you start seeing those weird sort of anomalies in publishing, where you suddenly have 5 books with the word girl in the title, or, you know, domestic
train
thrillers and, you know, that sort of thing, because it's a safe bet that that will sell. And this year the safe bet is feminist fiction, which I found really interesting, because maybe a few years ago that wouldn't have been the safe mainstream bet, but it very much is this year. So there were multiple novels, often debut novels by young women, that were going for huge amounts of money, all the publishers fighting for them. And there's quite a lot. A lot of them are not necessarily dystopian in the same way that Handmaid's Tale is, but they're all sort of looking at things, sort of challenges to female autonomy. So you've got sort of, there's this book called After the Flood, which is set in a post-apocalyptic world, and it's a mother looking for her daughter. There's another one called, I think it's pronounced Vardo, by one of my friends, actually, Kieran Millward Hargrave, which is all about the real-life witch trials in the 1600s in Norway. There's also another book called The Farm, which is sort of set around the idea that women produce the children for an elite and deliver them to this very sort of eerie-sounding farm. and they receive payment in return, but only if they follow very strict rules, which is sounding quite interesting and quite Handmaid's Tale-y. So you can sort of see that they've all sort of, you know, watched telly and they've seen Handmaids do very well, and they've seen Naomi Alderman's The Power win the Baileys last year, and they've all just kind of gone, okay, this is our surefire bet this year.
And one of the odd things about the fair is that on the one hand you have all these new signings, which are not going to actually appear in the bookshops till next year.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you have all the foreign exhibitors whose novels often have been around for a very long time.
Yes.
Sort of trying to sell them before they actually publish. So I did a couple of panels with various Baltic authors because they always have a market focused country. This time they had three. They had Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania. And they were publicising very, very well-received novels. Most of them had won prizes, had been translated, in the case of Arvidas Šlepikas's fantastic Shadow of Wolves, into seven languages already, but we have to wait till next year to get it here.
Yeah. And how long ago did it come out?
It was the best. It became the best-selling novel in Lithuania in 2012.
Oh, wow. I mean, that is the weird thing about translated fiction.
Yeah. I happen to know about The Shadow of Wolves because I did a panel with two Latvian writers, a children's writer and a novelist, and Arvidas, and Rebecca Stott, who's, as you, a lot of people listening to this will know, won the Costa Biography Prize last year with In the Days of Rain, about growing up in an extreme Brethren cult. And when I started doing it, I was thinking, how on earth is this going to work? Four authors and a translator, because Arvidas doesn't speak very good English. Mm. And one of the themes that came out of it was the manipulation of family life in the early years. And Nora Eksteina, who I have to recommend her novel Soviet Milk, one of the Latvians, has written about, she calls it the poisoned milk of the Soviet era, and how the relationship between a mother and a child are damaged. And of course, Rebecca Stott's story, which is not Soviet, it was in England, but it was a lot about how the family relationships in an extreme cult are damaged. And we talked about this, and I suddenly looked round and all three of the women panellists were crying. Mm. And then I looked out into the audience and there were rows and rows of women crying, with tears pouring down their face. It was a really extraordinary moment, because you think these are hard-bitten publishing people. And but it was also a connection, because sometimes these market focus things can seem quite remote because the books aren't available yet in some cases, and the cultures, until you've actually read the books, the cultures can seem quite unattainable. And I suddenly thought, my goodness, this is something that we have in our shared history of the last 30-40 years, is, you know, these incredibly damaged relationships. And then you can relate it to my own history, which is a child who is sent away to boarding school 3,000 miles across the world at the age of 7. And you just think, actually, the damaging of families by these strange practices in Europe is a bond between us, which was very, very powerfully evident in that session.
Do you think any publishers were sort of eyeing off that talk and going, okay, this is clearly something that will work for us?
Rebecca would be the person to do it. Actually, she would do it brilliantly. I do. I think it would be a great subject.
Yeah.
And the other thing I did, just incidentally, to pick up the sort of slightly less than cheery theme, was I did a I did a session on human rights and the Prix Voltaire, which is a prize that's been run by the International Publishers Association since 2005. And it's for authors who show exemplary courage in upholding freedom to publish and enable, this is the rubric, and enabling others to exercise the right to freedom of expression. And my session was about looking back at where they are now, where the winners are now. And this year's winner is Gui Minhai, who's the Hong Kong bookseller who was abducted in 2015 in Thailand, who then was released and then was re-abducted in January.
Yes, he was with some Swedish diplomats on a train, and the Chinese officials got on the train and left with him, and he hasn't been seen since. Is that right?
Yeah. And so the participant was his daughter, who actually wasn't able to be there because she was sick. But I was chatting to her afterwards by email, and she said that, very worryingly, we haven't had any updates since, other than official statements that he's suspected of trafficking in state secrets. I think this really demonstrates to what lengths the Chinese state is willing to go in order to silence people. Mm. And the other person who was there on the panel was the widow of a previous winner who was actually awarded the prize posthumously, Faisal Arifin Dipan, who was hacked to death in Bangladesh in his office in 2015. Mm. And his widow, who was a medical doctor, has taken on the business of running his publishing firm.
Wow.
Well, she's got two small children and she's widowed, and she is living in Dhaka running his outfit from the office in which he was murdered.
Wow.
And I just think that this is one of the things about this sort of international fair, is you realise we're so lucky, really.
Yeah.
You know, and the industry is under such threat. The freedom of expression is under such threat in so many parts of the world. And there are so many people doing such brilliant work to keep all the doors open and keep the possibility of conversation continuing.
Mm. And I suppose, like, keeping on that global eye, we got the Man Booker International shortlist as well, which is interesting. I mean, we were talking about it not that long ago, probably about a month ago on this podcast. But it's interesting to see which six books of the 13 are still there.
We got three right, Chan. But we'd ruled out Han Kang and Laszlo Crouch and Korkai, partly on the basis that they were previous winners.
And they're both there.
And they're both wrong. Are wonderful. They both are obviously wonderful authors.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, they're certainly both illustrous in their own ways, particularly Krasna Hawkeye.
But you got some gossip about it, didn't you, that which suggests that it is quite hotly contested this year.
Yes, I've heard that, particularly when it came to whittling down to the shortlist, there were quite heated discussions among the judges, which, you know, I always love a bit of literary gossip, so, you know, I think that only bodes well.
but it's sort of, you can see how it could happen. So, for example, there were two books from Spain on the long list, and you wouldn't necessarily want to put two books from Spain.
So exactly.
Ended up with Antonia Munoz Molina's Like a Fading Shadow going in. And then there are two books translated by Frank Wynne.
Yes.
and they've ended up with Virginie Despentes, Vernon's Subutex 1, which sounds incredibly off-putting. I don't like that title at all. But
apparently it's really, really good.
It's apparently totally
brilliant.
I still
haven't seen a copy, but, you know, if it wins, you know, it's going to be announced in 22nd of May, so I hope I get a copy before then.
It had a review from Eileen Battersby, who's a wonderful critic in the Irish Times, which is, you know, one of those reviews to die for. She says, the stage is set for what will prove one of the books of the year, if not the decade.
Wow.
As it is the first volume of a trilogy that already has a cult following in France. The best advice is simply to read it and pass on the word. We don't get better than that, do
no
you? And just for people who didn't catch us last time, it's about Vernon, an old 50 something year old record store owner whose patron suddenly dies, so he lands up in all sorts of trouble among the sort of shark pools of Parisian music world.
He basically there's a whole thread of it that he becomes homeless because he can't support himself, his shop goes out of business, and then just as he becomes homeless, he makes a comment on Facebook that becomes extremely contentious, and everyone starts talking about this guy called Vernon. But because he's homeless, he hasn't got internet access anymore, so he actually doesn't know that the whole world is talking about something he said, which is quite a nice,
very cool concept. Yeah. Isn't it? And she's, you know, I haven't read this, but she's a very cool lady, isn't she? Ever since her very first novel, Baise Moi, was published in 1992. She's sort of had a knack of being where the action is.
Mm.
So I'd actually, you know, from a position of ignorance, and I will now hie me away to read it, I sort of think that she has quite a good chance. What about the others?
Well, I mean, you love Olga, right?
Oh, I love Olga.
Yes, so let's all vote
for Olga
to win.
That's Olga Tokarczuk from Poland.
I mean, The Hand Kang is a very weird book. And so she won a couple of years ago for a novel called The Vegetarian, which was a fantastic winner. And it really did establish South Korean literature as sort of something to pay attention to in this country, because before it was just completely ignored. This book is very weird. It's a very strange, it really does stretch the bound of what a novel is. It's very fragmentary, and it really sort of, it draws upon her own story in that she, before she was born, she had an older sibling who died very young. So it's sort of a meditation on grief and something that really happened to her, but it's also fictionalized in a way, and also a sort of exploration of the symbolism of the color white, hence the title. It's very weird. There's photos, there's bits and pieces in there, but, you know, I mean, like the Gabriella Ybarra, who was on the long list for her book The Dinner Guest, that is quite similar in a way that she's writing about her grandfather's assassination, and she's got photos in there from sort of the news reports at the time. Very true, but also fictionalized, because she doesn't know the whole story.
That was the Spanish one that lost out.
Lost out to the Molina, who is a Spanish author also writing about an assassination, which is quite weird. But that, as a sort of as a book, when you're holding it, it does feel like a novel, and just in the way it's conveyed. The Han Kang, maybe it's a matter of translation from Korean, but The Han Kang, really, it just doesn't feel like a novel to me.
And the other one that you're slightly ambivalent about is Ahmed Sadawi's Frankenstein in Baghdad.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a cool concept. And I wonder whether this
is the concept.
So the concept is that there's an old junk dealer in Baghdad, in US-occupied Baghdad. The streets are sort of full of rubble and it's a very damaged city and the people are basically abandoned. And so as an act of protest, he starts gathering up body parts from the street to assemble into a corpse to make a sort of political statement that, you know, body parts are just being left on the street and we are being ignored. And then the corpse runs away. He doesn't have the corpse disappears. And so suddenly you've got this sort of Frankenstein figure roaming the streets of Baghdad. All these strange murders start happening. It's such a cool concept. And it is actually executed quite well. My problem is that it does read like a translated novel. And I know that sounds like a very strange thing to say, but I do very strongly feel that when you translate a novel, it has to work in the language in which it's translated.
I so agree with you. I've had a bit of a battle about this on the blog, our blog thread.
There's this idea that you shouldn't fiddle with it, but it has to work in every language it's translated in. And if you need to alter it slightly, you just need to alter it. And so Deborah Smith, who is Han Kang's translator, she has done this and actually works very closely with Han Kang in order to get Korean into English, which is a very hard transition, apparently. And so they do change things together, but they do change things. And this is being translated from Arabic, and I feel like there's something lost there in that translation that's just not coming across in English.
So, Benedict Wells might not be a name well known to English readers, but The End of Loneliness, his fourth novel, has sold over 200,000 copies so far in Germany. And the novel was on Der Spiegel's bestseller list for 80 weeks, 30 of which it was on the top 10. To date, The End of Loneliness has been published in 27 languages and is coming out in 27 countries. This is his first translation into English. So Sian asked him, 2 years after it came out in Germany, it must be strange reading his own book from a distance and in a different language. What was that like?
Yes, it was always a dream of mine to be once translated into English, and so I couldn't believe it when I finally got the English translation by the wonderful Charlotte Collins. Mm. And it also felt strange to me because, like you said, the book was already published years ago in Germany, and so I had already a certain distance to the text, and then it was all in another language too, so I could read more or less for the first time a text of mine like it wasn't from me.
Yeah.
I sometimes even hated the author for being so hard or cruel in certain topics. And it was a very interesting experience.
And what was it like working with Charlotte? Because Charlotte was your translator for the English version. Were there many things that didn't translate into English?
Yeah, there were at least a few. I mean, we were always writing emails with questions. She was questioning me or asking me, what do you exactly mean with that phrase? And sometimes I was asking her, why do you choose this special word and not the other one? And like this. And for example, also the title is pretty tricky because loneliness, the German title is Vom Ende der Einsamkeit. This is more or less on the end of loneliness or about the end of loneliness, because I don't think there is an end of loneliness, but you can write about it. Mm. And so you have the first time in history that the German word vom is shorter and more elegant than most of the other languages can offer here. And the same as Einsamkeit is not exactly loneliness. Loneliness is more Alleinsein, which is also existing in Germany, which is neutral. Like you can have a good time when you're alone. But Einsam is filled with emotions and also with desire. And sometimes, it can be considered as something more negative. So you can't hit always another language by 100%, but you can try to come as close as possible. And this is what we tried. And Charlotte Collins is an amazing translator. I'm a very, very lucky person that she translated my book. And she found so many creative solutions for these problems. And I was more this Inspector Columbo guy who always came back with another question. Why did you do this? And I want to understand. And she was so patient with me. And
I mean, you mentioned before, we were talking before we came in to record, that there's a scene in the book that involves Jules, the main character, and his brother taking pot shots with a gun at some wedding presents.
Yeah.
And there's a particular cartoon character that's mentioned in the German version, which doesn't really translate beyond Germany.
Yes, and in the English version, it's now Homer Simpson.
Yes.
And the Swedish translator once asked me what I would recommend to use instead of the only in German existing cartoon character, because he had a certain idea. And I said, well, let's make it a Smurf. And he said, yeah, this is what I have. And I think Smurf is the perfect solution, but yeah. Homer Simpson works absolutely well too.
At its heart, this book is very hard to sum up as a book, but it feels, looking at the structure of the book, it's a book very much about time and the passing of it and how that can bring us both pleasure and pain in various ways. And it's also kind of about happiness as well and the absence of, and I mean, this book is best described as very pensive. You said before you felt guilt about being cruel to your own characters, and there is a lot of sadness in this book. But let's start with the time aspect of it, because in terms of how the novel is structured, you start with Jules at a later point in his life. He's an adult and he is emerging from a coma after an accident. And then as he comes out of that coma, he's falling back into his memories and sort of considering his life up until that point. So how did you come up with that structure? Because it's a very elegant way.
Thank you very much. Well, with this structure, you first ask the reader for some patience, because it's kind of a bit overwhelming. You have two time lines going on after a few pages and like this, but later on you have a lot of profit out of it. And I don't know, this was pretty clear for me in the very beginning that I will work with the structure. Other things were more difficult, but it was indeed the time that dragged me to the story. I wanted to write first about how little mistakes in your youth and childhood, little decisions, can have such an big impact later on in your life when you almost have forgotten. So this was what I first wanted to write about. And later on, after 4 or 5 years, I realized that this is a book about things you, the unchangeable. Is there something unchangeable in life? What always remains same in every version of your life? It doesn't matter if you lose your parents or not. Doesn't matter if you move there or not. Is there something like this in your life? Or can you get something back from what you have lost in your childhood when you're a grown up? And this, it crystallized during the writing process that this is the main topic. And the time is also an important topic, but not the main topic. But the time was the reason why I wanted to write this novel.
We have this film in English-speaking countries, I suppose, called Sliding Doors, which had Gwyneth Paltrow in it back in the 90s. And so there is this phrase that we use a lot in English writing and conversation, where you talk about a sliding doors moment, a sort of moment where your life could have diverged on two points. And there is actually a moment where Jules talks about imagining a fork in the road in his life, that his life could have been different if perhaps this hadn't happened, or considering whether it would have actually been exactly the same if...
Yeah, he, for a very long time in his life, he is not accepting his alternative version of his life without his parents. He always secretly would change his life back into the old one with his parents alive. And he has to make peace with this new version of his life, because if not, he will be always unhappy.
The book is literally in Jules's head. You're with him the entire time. How do you build a character like Jules? Because the reader doesn't necessarily have to like him, but we have to like spending time with him, I suppose, because you're in his head the whole time. How did you build him?
Well, he mostly was just there. And with each draft, I was diving more into these characters. I was living with these characters, also with his siblings and with the other characters in the book. I was spending 7 years with them. It was a little bit, when we were talking about Sliding Doors moment, this was a beautiful mind moment when I had a dinner with friends and, oh, look, who's only visible for me at the other end of the table? It's Jules and his brother and sister. And they were always there with me. And I was thinking constantly about them and their feelings. And you're right, Jules is a difficult character. In the first place, he's probably not easy to like. I hope later on it's easier. But he was interesting for me because there was also a draft after 4 years in which I was changing the perspective from first perspective to third perspective.
Right.
I felt that I probably need more distance to him during the writing process. And this was a big mistake in many ways. And one of it was that suddenly Jules was in front of the camera. Jules thought, Jules thinks, Jules walks, whatever. But he wasn't strong enough to carry the whole book on his tender shoulders.
Right.
So I needed to put him back behind the camera, because what he has and what he can offer the reader is his special view, his memories, with which he lets the other characters in the book shine. But therefore, he needs to be the director and not the actor. And this is why first perspective was necessary for him. And since I never studied writing either, I had had to learn everything due to mistakes like this. And this was definitely also one of the reasons why it took me 7 years to write this book.
Well, also, one of the drafts was really, really long, wasn't
yes,
it? It was like 800 pages.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you tackle whittling that down? It's about 300 pages.
Yeah,
now.
I wanted to cut the story, yeah, and I wanted to have it as tight and short as possible because I wanted to have so many gaps between events and the chapters. I wanted to have gaps the reader must fill or is allowed to fill. So there is a second book next to the book, which is only in the head of the reader, and it's different mm-hmm. by each reader. This was very important for me. Yeah, so I was thinking a lot why to, because the book is describing 35 years. I was always thinking, why do I write about the engagement party of the sister, but not about the wedding of the brother? And I always had a huge buffet to choose the little scenes I describe in the end. And this took me also a while, but it was a lot of fun to cut it and to see, this maybe works and this not. And it was like a Jenga tower. And I was pulling out little scenes, little chapters. And as long as the tower was standing, everything was fine. And when the tower was crashing down, I had to bring that little scene back in. And
I mean, because a lot of the time it does jump from scene to scene. But each of those moments tends to be something that's quite formative for Jules and something significant to his growth as a human. And a lot of these moments are very, very sad. He's got quite a lot of sadness in his life.
Yeah.
How did you go about tackling that? Because I suppose writing a book that is so sad, I'm thinking of another book that we had a couple of years ago called A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Which was a very divisive book because some people thought it was almost too cruel to her characters. She was being too horrible and almost exploitative.
Yeah.
How do you temper writing about sadness without making it, you know, melodramatic?
This was the most important order I gave to myself. I never will write something only negative. Never. Because we will all die in the end. That's a fact. And on the way, many other cruel things are happening. So it's not my job to just write about that and take away all the hope. What I wanted to do is I wanted to be as sincere as possible. That, for example, if somebody has lost his parents, like the siblings in the book, I wanted that he feels understood. And this is why I was not using irony or sarcasm or like this as protection. Or I didn't want to look away. I wanted to look long enough to these cruel, sometimes cruel events, to find something to put against, something positive, because there is. Yeah, we all will die, but why do we? Why can we still be happy? There are things to find, and so this was my job with the book, more or less. I wanted to have an equation with a lot of minus, but in the end, it's maybe a slight plus. Not more. More is lying, but and I didn't want to lie, but I wanted to find this little plus. And so this is what I did on the writing process. And so I had to outbalance many things. I was sometimes cutting things which maybe would have destroyed that balance and like this. And so, yeah, I allowed myself to be a little bit positive in the end, because you are more or less a director. And what is a happy end? A happy end is just an end in a certain point. And later on, maybe bad things will happen again, and like bad things happened before this special moment. So I allowed myself to leave the book not in a very happy endish moment, but in a moment where there is hope, mm. where there is some positive things are going on, where people start to make their peace for certain events.
That's so funny you say that, because reading it throughout, I couldn't help but think that a sad ending for Jules was sort of inevitable because of a lot of the things that happened in the book. But it sort of ends on such a, I don't want to spoil it for anyone, but it ends with such a note of contentment that you almost feel very upbeat when you finish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jules is a writer in the book, and there's a lot of conversations about writing and reading. There's one other character who's a writer as well, who's quite prominent in it. But there was a moment where Alva, who is Jules's friend and eventual love interest, she says, "You were always a writer. You're a person who remembers and preserves," which is something that rhymes very true with a lot of writers that I speak to for this show and for my job, that a lot of them talk about going for a walk just so they can go eavesdrop on what someone might be saying down the road and then taking it and putting it in their notebook and preserving it to call upon. Is that how you work as well?
No. I'm more this... I work a lot from the inside, actually. It's I have little observations I make, not on purpose, not I need new creative stuff, I go out on the streets. It's more like by chance mostly, or in coincidence, but little observations, little emotions, sometimes also from my youth and like this, and I carry them my whole life and observe them my whole life, and suddenly I feel I can use them, or I write them down. And so most of the things in my books come from the inside, or from things I have experienced in my youth and in my childhood and like this.
Well, I haven't read your other books because I'm afraid my German is very,
very
poor. Are they?
Yeah, they are.
I was reading the synopsis and occasionally it would refer to youth, and I sort of thought, well, youth must be very, very important to Benedict as a writer, that it must be something that interests you.
I mean, the emotions in the youth are so pure, so unfiltered, so not protected, that of course they are pretty strong. And also the way you observe as a teenager is very interesting, because it's also very pure. And you see things you start to not see when you're older. This explains also like the funny trick everybody has to experience probably in life, when you see things on your parents you don't like and suddenly you make the same. How did that happen? Yeah, because you don't see in the special clear way that you were used to when you were younger. So I have this rucksack full of these observations and feelings and emotions, and this is actually my base when I write. And for example, I was living several years in Barcelona, and this has absolutely no impact on my writing.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that, do you think? Do you sort of draw lines?
I don't know, it's two different worlds. I cannot tell.
When you were younger, you changed your last name to Wells, which
yes.
is actually a reference to a book people might be familiar with. It's a John Irving character, Homer Wells, from
yes.
the Cider House Rules. You must love John Irving, first of all.
You can say that.
Yeah.
No, I was 13 years in boarding school. I came to boarding school when I was 6 years old. A parent of mine was sick, couldn't take care. The other one was self-employed, financial trouble. I had to work all the time, so they were separated. So boarding school was the only thing to do, but it felt somehow I was suddenly, when I was six, I was in a boarding school with five other boys in a sleeping room, and this was my new home, and this felt a little bit like an orphanage. And so I was 13 years in these institutions, and so I felt always connected somehow to the character of Homer Wells in John Irving's book. But the main reason is that John Irving is the reason why I became a writer. I was 15 when I discovered his books, and I was never that much into German literature. At that time, late 90s, I thought, well, the German books, okay, these are writers, then I probably don't want to be a writer. And then I discovered John Irving's books, and suddenly this was another option to be a writer, to write books like this. And I thought, okay, if this is a writer too, then I maybe want to be a writer again.
Yeah.
So his books really inspired me. And yeah, and so it was also like an homage, I was choosing his name.
Well, he's written a blurb for your book.
Yeah, this was like a fairy tale. I had tears in my eyes.
Oh,
I couldn't believe it. Yeah, this was, you have to imagine that from the perspective of my 15-year-old alter ego that discovered his books, all these borders on the way to that he at least could read my book, because it has to be published, translated, and then he was reading it and he was liking it and giving me that blur. This was really like unbelievable.
Sian was speaking with Benedict Wells. The End of Loneliness, translated by Charlotte Collins, is out now, published by Septa. Next week, they're the people we turn to in our moments of direst need, but who can doctors turn to in theirs? Caroline Elton joins us to talk about Almost Human and the toll that being superhuman plays on the only human. In the meantime, please subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers, and join the discussion on Twitter or by leaving a comment on the podcast page. If you prefer to contact us directly, you can email us at bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armistead.
And me, Sian Kane.
And our producer, Susanna Trezilian. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.